Okay, folks, welcome to a scintillating topic, which involves, of course, as most of you are indeed likely aware, some material, if not significant, changes to employment standards legislation, as well as the Labor Relations Act in Ontario. Alex and I are here today to take you through it as I suppose as hopefully as clearly as we can. There is much, of course, that will remain subject to future interpretations, applications, decisions, etc. But as of now, here's what we know about the legislation, which is what our session is all about today. So welcome to our e-learning with E2R. The topic is proposed changes to employment and labor legislation in Ontario are now law. So it is now law. So if you woke up in the middle of the night and said, oh, it must have just been a bad dream, no, it's not just a bad dream. It's now law. Before we get started, and as always, here are just a few reminders. If you have any questions during the presentation, feel free to use the chat box at the bottom right-hand side of your screen to type them out. We likely will respond to those questions sometimes, I know, or often we do it during the currency of the presentation, but in order to ensure that we complete the presentation, we will wait to respond until the end. Hopefully we'll have enough time and respond at that time. And of course, as you know, we're always here for all questions, so reach out to us and we, of course, will respond if we don't get to it in the presentation today. In case you've missed any of our past webinars, you can find the recordings over on e2rsolutions.com, and the PowerPoint presentation can be found on your member portal. We remind you that all of the information contained within our webinars is by way of overview only, not intended as a specific analysis of all areas of employment and labor law, and accordingly should not be relied upon as legal advice for any given situation. As always, and once again, we ask us and urge you to contact us for any specific questions related to the information in this webinar or any other topic, and for specific applicability of this topic area to your workplace. Unbelievably so, this is our last e-learning of 2017. I'm sure none of us are any older. We all look good, but nevertheless, we are marching forward to 2018. The date of our next e-learning will be January 24th, 2018. So without further ado, let's dig in. By way of agenda, we will give you some background information. We'll talk about, of course, employment standards changes, including new and amended leaves of absence, temporary help agencies. Look out if you are a temporary help agency, record-keeping requirements, enforcement, labor standards changes, and, of course, next steps. Given some of, or it necessarily involves a somewhat dry analysis when you are explaining legislation, we will nevertheless do our best, Alex and I, to keep this as interesting as we possibly can. So by way of background, on June 1st, 2017, following a lengthy review of Ontario's Employment Standards Act 2000 and the Labor Relations Act 1995, and by the way, the people that were most involved was, at least in theory, a management representative and a, let's call it a union representative. Some would say that the management representative has perhaps gone too far as it relates to some of the employee entitlements. But nevertheless, that's the background. They introduced the legislation to amend these two primary pieces of workplace legislation. This legislation became known as Bill 148, or more formally, the Fair Workplaces Better Jobs Act 2017. It received royal assent on November 27, 2017, so we are talking hot off the press, and, of course, will become law with various deadlines for compliance, and we're going to share with you what those deadlines are.
So let's begin with some of the changes to the minimum employment standards legislation in Ontario. And the first one that is going to impact a lot of you guys is the increase in minimum wage. So as you know, the current general minimum wage is $11.60 per hour. And so the government has decided to increase that substantially, in particular to $14 per hour as of January 1st, 2018, and $15 per hour the year after that. And then every October 1st following that, so October 21st, 2020, it's going to increase with inflation rate. So it's likely going to continue to increase year over year, and that's really what that is all about. In terms of some other minimum wages, there is still a liquor server's minimum wage that is going to apply. It is a lower wage rate, and that will only apply though now where the server does receive either tips or gratuities on a regular basis. And not in the slide, but still applicable, is the student minimum wage. So that's for students under the age of 18, where their hours of work do not exceed 28 in a work week, or they're working during a school holiday. That minimum wage as of January 1st, 2018 is going to $13.50 per hour, and then January 1st, 2019 to $14.10 per hour. So just some practical points on this. There's going to be no obligation to increase the wages of other employees. So even though minimum wage is increasing, you don't have to increase all of your employees' wages incrementally to match that minimum wage if they are receiving the current minimum wages. That is going to be subject to what we're talking about a little bit later in this presentation, which is this idea of equal pay for equal work, and we'll discuss that concept in depth later. And the second practical point is that any employee that is receiving minimum wage must have their wage rate adjusted. And as we typically advise clients, when we're adjusting wage rates, we often recommend entering into a new contract just to have the most up-to-date kind of paperwork in place. This will not be an opportunity to ask someone to sign a contract, because all we are doing is complying with minimum wage.
What's going to be interesting, we've already been asked a couple of times about, and as Alec mentions, how does this impact earners that earn in excess of minimum wage? Well, no legislative issue attached to that, but the practical reality on the ground is that we would anticipate that many employees will come forward and use minimum wage as the reference point for what their compensation ought to be. So if currently the delta between somebody's wages and minimum wage is a 15% over and above minimum wage, well, not surprisingly, some, if not many, will come forward and say, well, I need to maintain that delta of 15%. So there will be an upward pressure on wages across the board, and certainly, of course, any collective agreement environment with unions, there will be a consequential pressure across the board for wage increases. So that's going to be a future reality.
The second Employment Standards Act change is to vacation time and vacation pay. And so what is going to happen as of January 1st, 2018 is that employees with 5 years or more of service will now be entitled to 3 weeks of unpaid vacation time and 6% vacation pay. As you know, in Ontario, it has been a static 2 weeks unpaid vacation time and 4% of wages as vacation pay, regardless of years of service. That is now changing. So the practical implications are, many of you probably already offer your employees additional vacation based upon their seniority, but we're going to need to make sure that every employee with at least 5 years of service as of January 1st and thereafter is given an increase in their vacation entitlement if they're not at the 3 week per year mark. This change does align with other jurisdictions. So if you have employees in BC or Alberta, for example, they are already under this rule. And so what we're also going to want to make sure is employees that reach their 5 years of service during a vacation entitlement year, and many of you have a January 1st to the end of the year vacation entitlement year, once an employee reaches their anniversary date, their monthly accrual rate is going to have to jump up so it represents that 3 weeks per year. So oftentimes, if they're at 2 weeks, it's 0.836 days per month of an accrual rate, which equals 10 days. That's going to have to jump up to 1.25 as soon as they reach their five-year anniversary. And you also still need to make sure that all of your employees are taking the required minimum vacation after each year. And as many of you have discussed with us advisors, there is a deadline of the following year that that must be done. So we need to make sure that we're making all of our employees take their minimum amount of vacation time.
With respect to overtime, not a significant change. So everybody can take a deep breath on that one. This won't affect that many employers, but what the change relates to is where employees have more than one position. So if they hold more than one position and they're working overtime, they must be paid at the rate for the position they are working during the overtime period. It is not a blended rate, and that becomes effective January 1, 2018. We are going to talk about record keeping in due course in this presentation, but by way of note here, an employer is going to be required to document which overtime hours were worked at which rate and ensure the employee is paid accordingly. Public holiday pay, not surprisingly, most, if not all, of these changes necessarily give rise to higher employer costs. This is no exception. The formula is now changing so that employees are effectively entitled to their average regular daily wage. Right, so the formula now is wages earned in the pay period preceding the holiday divided by the number of days worked in the period. Those of you familiar with the formula now would know it's 4 weeks. Right, four-week period in the four-week period immediately preceding the week in which the statutory holiday falls, divided by 20. So now you have this new formula that will apply effective January 1st, 2018. So in essence, what that does, as you see in practical point number 3, is that change effectively entitles part-time employees now to a full day's pay. The additional practical points as it relates to aspects of the public holiday provisions include what you see in number 1, which is employers remain able to provide a substitute holiday to employees who work on a public holiday, but they now must provide a written statement which sets out the holiday the employee will work, the date of the substitute day, and the date of the agreement. Record keeping is now becoming, if it didn't already rise to the level of significant importance, it certainly does now, and employers must ensure any substitute days are recorded and that the payroll calculation for holiday pay is updated.
The next chunk of changes under Bill 148 relate to scheduling, and there's a number of unique things that the government has proposed and now passed. And the first one is that they've granted the right to employees to request a schedule or workplace location change if they've worked for your company for 3 months or more without fear of reprisal. Further, the employer is now required to either grant the employee's change or provide written reasons for the denial. And so what is missing in the legislation, and we'll get to know more as things kind of roll out from the Ministry of Labor, there is no clear direction as it relates to the reasonableness of the written reasons for denial. We're going to assume for the minute that the Ministry of Labor does not necessarily have the power to assess your reason, but the reason should be truthful and likely be made in good faith. And so that's going to be a difficult issue to navigate, especially when you run a bunch of different shifts. Certain employees will want to move off the night shift to the day shift, etc. And we're going to need to be prepared to provide written reasons that are truthful as to why that employee isn't permitted to change their shift.
And you know, this is, you know, it goes without saying that this puts an employer in a difficult position. So even as Alex identifies, let's even assume, and it arguably is a safe assumption, that the Ministry of Labor does not have the jurisdiction to evaluate the reasonableness of the employer's reasons. But even if that's the case, practically speaking, let's say using Alex's example, you say there's no availability on the day shift. That's the answer to somebody who's working the night shift. No availability. Then, 6 months later, there is availability. And the answer you gave was no availability. Well, now the employee says, well, that's what you told me. Well, of course, from the employer's perspective, there are a whole myriad of reasons why you wouldn't grant that employee's request, perhaps including performance deficiencies. And so, just to avoid ruffling feathers, the answer is no availability, which is true at the time. So by being forced to provide reasons, and written reasons, I might add, you're arguably could be placing yourself in the corner, at least from a practical standpoint, and that could create some difficult circumstances.
The other scheduling change that will be passed, all these scheduled changes, by the way, are effective January 1st, 2019, so we do have some time as it relates to these aspects of the presentation. The second one is generally known as the three-hour rule, or they call it reporting pay. And so as you know, currently, the rule was if someone has a shift that's longer than 3 hours and they report to work and they're sent home early, they must be paid no less than the greater of the wages earned during the working period or 3 hours at minimum wage. Well, that is now being changed, and there's a new formula which is going to essentially give that person the greater of 3 hours at the employee's regular rate of pay or the sum of the amount earned while working, so whether they work for 2 hours and they get 2 hours of pay, plus the remaining time at their regular rate. And so this would mean practically that the premium pay entitlement, if there is any, for those hours worked, will apply. An employee may actually earn more than 3 hours of pay. So it's a significant change in terms of it's not just 3 hours at minimum wage, as the threshold is 3 hours of regular pay. Again, we have some time to work through some of these kinks, as this change does not become effective until January 1st, 2019. And now Stuart's going to start with some other changes to the scheduling rules, and then we'll continue.
Hey, so bear in mind once again, I know Alex has repeated over and over because you're being provided with a wealth of information and sometimes it's hard to keep it all organized. So these scheduling changes are not effective until January 1, 2019. But let's take a look at the significance of these changes. Now with respect to shift cancellation, if a shift is canceled within 48 hours of its start, employees must be paid 3 hours at their regular rate of pay. 2 days. So if it's anything less than 2 full days, you got to pay 3 hours at the regular rate. There are, of course, exceptions that relate, as you can see, storms, power failures, weather conditions, etc. All right, so that is something you need to bear in mind as you plan 13 months ahead. On call, when employees are on call and are not called into work, they must be paid 3 hours at their regular rate of pay. And this is required for each 24-hour period that employees are on call. But they, of course, must be available to work for at least 3 hours at the relevant time. Now listen to the next point. Employees can refuse to accept shifts without repercussion if their employer asks them to work with less than 4 days' notice with some limited exceptions. So if you are asked to work, right, and it's all clearly not on a scheduled day of work, right, you can refuse to accept the shift without any repercussion whatsoever if it's with less than 4 days' notice, unless emergencies, you see threat to public safety and reasons as prescribed means regulations. And you see the definition of emergency is pretty limited in scope, right? So those situations won't arise all that often. So key scheduling changes, the 48 hours, the 4 day refusal without repercussion. And remember, when you say without repercussion, an employee can allege there may be 99 good reasons, for example, why you terminate somebody. One of those reasons related to the fact that, you know what, they're not a team player in the sense that they continue to refuse shifts when they're offered because it was less than 4 days' notice. And so if the timing of a termination, I'm just using that example, is 1 day after the employee refused the shift, well, you can bet on it that that employee is going to allege it's a reprisal action, which permits reinstatement under the Employment Standards Act, back wages, etc.
So while many of these changes are significant, this next one is unique to Ontario and pretty significant to your workplace. And essentially what they've kind of called it is this equal pay for equal work provision. And what that means is that casual, part-time, temporary, and seasonal employees are entitled to be paid the same as full-time employees when and if they perform substantially the same job for the same employer. And substantially the same has been defined as not only including same, but it doesn't necessarily mean the work is identical. So again, no guidance from the Ministry of Labour as to what that particularly means, but if the job has a similar value to the employer, it's likely going to fall under that substantially the same designation. And so as you can appreciate now, temporary employees, part-time employees, are going to have to receive the same rate of pay as their full-time counterparts. And what is even more onerous to the employer is that a casual, part-time, temporary, and seasonal employee is permitted to ask the employer to review their wage if they believe that they are not being paid as the same as their full-time counterpart. Not only are they allowed to ask without repercussion, again, for asking, but the employer must respond with either the increase or a written explanation of why they receive a different rate or notification that they receive the same rate. Now, there are some exceptions. There is some guidance here. The first exception is if the wage rate is based upon a seniority system, so based upon years of service. The second one is a merit system, so if you are doing progressive discipline, performance management, which we always recommend employers do, that's becoming even more important now to be able to point to the merits of the wage rate. The third exception is a system that measures earnings by quantity or quality of production. And the third one is any other factor other than sex or employment status, so other than them being a casual, part-time, temporary, seasonal employee. As noted with our discussion on the scheduling work location change request, the Ministry of Labour has yet to provide us with any direction as it relates to this very open exception to this rule, but we're going to assume for the moment that the factor must be reasonable and must be based in good faith. And we don't know exactly yet how far the Ministry of Labour is allowed to investigate our reasons that we are providing to our employees. But as Stuart mentioned before, it might lead to some awkward conversations as it relates to certain performance difficulties or attitude, et cetera, to justify why that person is not getting the same rate as their full-time counterpart.
And you know, Alex, this is just you talk about the dog's breakfast. If, and I'm talking out loud, if if, as an employer, I'm required to respond with a written explanation as to why there exists a difference, then am I necessarily now, let's say it was just two employees, one's full-time, one's part-time, it's going to be obvious who we're talking about, which full-timer. Am I now, in essence, disclosing, I'm going to call it personal information related to the full-time employee to establish the distinction or differentiation between that full-timer and the casual to answer the casual employee's or part-time employee's request that he or she be paid the same as the full-timer? I mean, who knows where that necessarily goes, but to Alex's point about the performance management process and the proper documentation in place so that you have something to point to identify the reason for the difference in compensation, well, that's going to be helpful. But once again, what are we sharing if it's a written explanation of the difference? I mean, are we sharing the private information of the other employee? Don't know. I don't know.
Ryan, I'm just regarding this provision, there is going to be some time to make sure we are in compliance with the equal pay for equal work provisions. This change, unlike some of the other ones, is going to be effective April the 1st, 2018. Just some practical points to keep in mind. Oftentimes, our clients, with our guidance, have policies in place that prohibit employees from discussing their wage rate amongst other employees. And so what the government has now said is that employees are permitted to disclose their rate of pay to each other for the purposes of determining or assisting in determining whether the employer is complying with this provision. Thankfully, we believe that we can still prohibit full-time employees amongst themselves from discussing their wages because we don't need to pay the same wage rate to all full-time employees, but we're not going to be able to prohibit full-time employees discussing their wage rate with part-time, casual, temporary, or seasonal employees. And again, no reprisal for the request for a review of their wage rate is permitted. And so, as Stuart also alluded to earlier, once an employee raises this issue, if they are terminated shortly thereafter, even if it's unrelated to their request, optically there's going to be some challenges with that termination. And lastly, please keep in mind that an employer is not permitted to reduce an employee's wage rate in order to comply with this provision. So you can't reduce the full-time employee's wage rate to match that of the part-time. In order to comply, you have to increase, where required, the part-time employee's wage rate to match the full-time employee.
And, you know, looking at it from another angle, although it would appear the legislation simply permits a full-time employee to disclose compensation information, what about that full-time employee who's not interested in disclosing? And that part-time casual employee says, yeah, but under legislation you're supposed to, which is an inaccurate characterization of it. But you could see how that will progress so that there will be a sense of guilt attached to a full-time employee or animosity between casual part-time employees and full-time employees who are unwilling to disclose what their compensation is. So, as you can see, we're just scratching the surface of the possible difficult permutations that may arise from the application of these changes. Okay, training and students, not a significant change per se. So, you know, all ESA requirements and entitlements apply to people receiving training for work through their employer. So if, however, you're doing experiential learning that's run through a university, community college, private career college, or high school, you're excluded from the requirements and entitlements under the employment standards legislation. Students who are employed and regularly work more than 3 hours are to be paid for at least 3 hours, even if they work less than three. That comes into force January 1st, 2019. Just by way of note, when we're talking about students, right now, essentially, there are very stringent training requirements in order to be exempt from the application of the employment standards legislation. There are six conditions. They all have to be met, typically very difficult to meet. Really, the only exemption is something that's attached to an educational institution, and that remains available. But at the end of the day, we are talking about very limited opportunities now, very limited opportunities now for any kind of internship program. As you see from the exemptions, they are continuing to review. Special Advisory Committee is looking into the exemptions that are currently in the Employment Standards Act and special industry rules, including consultation with affected stakeholders. This review is including exemptions in place for managers and supervisors. The current proposal is, by the special advisors, is that you can only be exempt as a manager if you earn 150% of the minimum wage and you exercise those managerial duties that would otherwise exclude you. But the addition of this earnings threshold, now bear in mind, just want to make sure we're clarifying this, it is not part of the legislation right now. We will likely see changes in the not too distant future relating to this, but that's what's currently being discussed right now at the special advisor level, let's call it. So we may in future see a minimum earning threshold in order for you to be a manager, and for those in the retail environment in particular, that could be very, very interesting. There's also going to be further reviews, as you see there, for a variety of professions, as it were, architects, domestic workers, homemakers, IT professionals, pharmacists. You can see the list there, and feedback is to be heard up until December 1st, 2017.
Let's review the last two employment standards changes before we touch on the new and amended leaves of absences. The first one relates to employee claims and the obligation that an employee is not required to contact their employer about their issues before they file an ESA complaint. So there's no mechanism now or no requirement to deal directly with the employee to resolve their issues if they wish to go right to the Ministry of Labor. The second change related to those ESA complaints is the Director of Employment Standards no longer has the power to refuse to assign an employment standards officer to investigate an ESA complaint due to insufficient information. So currently, or not currently now even, we'll get to that in a second, but historically, the director could look at the claim and say there's not enough information here to proceed with an investigation. That power is no longer there, essentially meaning all complaints are going to result in an ESA investigation. And the last ESA change, specifically related to the minimum standards, is a huge one for a lot of our clients, and that's employee misclassification. So there is now a statutory prohibition with regards to treating people who meet the employee test as independent contractors. And so what that is going to mean is that if we are treating employees at law as independent contractors, we're going to run afoul with minimum standards legislation, which can result in penalties, prosecution, public disclosure, perhaps other monetary penalties related to the misclassification of that individual. And the onus, like many onuses, is going to rest with the employer. So the employer is going to have to prove that they have not misclassified an employee as an independent contractor. And there's a penalty now that's going to apply, which will include up to 2 years of payment for missed benefits with no caps plus those fines that we mentioned. One of the larger issues that we may face is that once the Ministry of Labor has on their radar that we have misclassified one person as an independent contractor when they should have been an employee, that could likely lead to a workplace review of all of your independent contractors, which then could then relate to a bunch of other consequences as relates to those people who may also be misclassified. And unfortunately, there is no definitive test as it relates to who is an employee versus who is an independent contractor, or at least there's no guidance from the Ministry of Labor as it relates to which actual test they are going to be using. There's a number of tests out there that relate to a bunch of different things. At this time, we don't know which test they are going to be applying, but keep in mind, minimum standards legislation is meant to protect employees, so they're going to take the most favorable employee test, I imagine, to apply to see whether someone has been misclassified. And unfortunately, this change became effective when the legislation was given royal assent, which was November 27, 2017. So this is already in play, and we're yet to see whether this is just going to rise out of workplace investigations, or it's going to primarily be driven by independent contractor complaints to the Ministry of Labor, but it does represent a significant change.
And, you know, this change is, you know, we're shaking our heads on this end, excuse me, because if you look at these issues often arise before CRA, Canada Revenue Agency, and very reasonable people will disagree as to the characterization of the relationship. It is a determination based on well over 100 indicia. So it's not an easy evaluation or assessment. So to create legislation, to draft legislation that says you are prohibited from misclassifying, well, I could put 10 lawyers in the room. Five will characterize it perhaps as an independent contractor, and five might characterize it as an employment relationship. So it's rather remarkable in that regard, together with, just as a by the way, in many situations, as probably many of you are aware, both parties want the relationship to be characterized as an independent contractual relationship. But now the Ministry of Labor is saying to both parties, you're prohibited, employer, from misclassifying it, even though the employee, in quotes, wanted it. Pretty remarkable. Okay, we're going to move on now to leaves of absence, and there are a number of changes to leaves of absence. We'll just take you through it. The personal emergency leave is the most significant for most employers, and the reason why it's the most significant is that formally, as you will see in point number two, it applied to employers with 50 or more employees. That threshold is gone. You now have an employer with one employee who now has to provide that employee with 10 days of personal emergency leave per calendar that is to be used, as you see the definition, personal illness, injury, or medical emergency for the employee or certain family members. It also includes, you know, urgent matters as well that impact that employee. And urgent, quite frankly, can include my cat is sick and I have to take care of my cat. So now you have all employers, regardless of size in Ontario, that are required to provide employees with 10 days of personal emergency leave. Two of those 10 must be paid, and they are the first two of the 10. So not only if you are a small employer are you now required to provide 10 days of personal emergency leave, you are now required to pay for two of those emergency leave days. And as you can see, an employee must only work for 1 week to be entitled to the paid days. And indeed, unpaid days can be taken in the first week of employment. The entitlement is to pay at the regular rate only, not overtime or shift premium to be included. Now, here's an interesting point. Employers cannot require an employee to support their personal emergency leave with a doctor's note. So if the employee requires a personal emergency leave day for reasons that relate to medical, that employee's medical condition, you cannot require the employee produce a medical note in support. Cannot. Although you can ask for reasonable evidence supporting the request for the personal emergency leave for days that are other than medical, you can't do it for medical. So what does the conniving employee do? Takes all 10 on the basis of medical. You cannot ask for support. Now, you will notice our point below, which we're going to get to in a second. There's, in effect, a form, you know, one of the ways we've already considered getting around it is to secure medical information that relates to fitness to return to work, accommodation, etc. In that way, you're securing supporting medical information. But you're going to have to ensure that that's drafted properly so that you're not running afoul of this clear prohibition on employers. Practical point number one is needs to be emphasized. You've got to look at your internal policies now relating to sick and or personal days to ensure compliance. Right? Your sick days may not meet the definition of PEL days under the Act. So this is a fundamental change for you small employers out there, and even for those over 50. So you need to take a look at your policies, and of course this change comes into effect January 1st, 2018.
Right before we move on to the next leave of absence slide, we are going to be discussing with our clients some effective strategies on how to address these two paid days, which may involve, quite frankly, looking at the removal of other paid days. So if you offer floating days or paid bereavement leave, we may be taking away from those days to now accord them to be personal emergency leave days. Obviously, that's going to be subject to a collective agreement in unionized workplaces, but that's something that we will discuss on an individual basis with our clients. There is a new leave of absence also now, effective January 1st, 2018, and that's the domestic or sexual violence leave. Now, this new leave is going to be available for employees who have been the victim of or who have a child who has been the victim of domestic or sexual violence or who have experienced a threat of domestic or sexual violence. They don't need to be a victim of the actual violence. As long as there has been a threat made against them, they are entitled to this leave, and we'll align what those leave requirements are below. But the basis for the leave: one, to seek medical attention for the employee or the child of the employee in respect to a physical or psychological injury or disability caused by the domestic or sexual violence. Two, to obtain services from a victim services organization for the employee or the child. Three, to obtain psychological or other professional counseling for the employee or the child. To relocate either temporarily or permanently as a result of domestic or sexual violence. Four, or five, rather, to seek legal or law enforcement assistance, including preparing for or participating in any civil or criminal proceedings related to or resulting from domestic or sexual violence. And that could even relate to perhaps divorce or child custody hearings where there is an allegation of domestic and sexual violence present. And the last one is such other purposes as prescribed. So if they issue regulations relating to this leave, that's where we'll find those other additional bases for the leave. The leave is available only to employees who have been employed for at least 13 weeks. So you need to be with your company 13 weeks to get this leave. They also have a dual entitlement. There is 10 days and up to 15 weeks each calendar year. And the first 5 days of the leave are required to be paid by the employer. The employee, unlike personal emergency leave days, must provide reasonable evidence if the employer requests it, but employers must establish ways to ensure the confidentiality of the related documents. And as I'm sure you can appreciate, given the sensitive nature of this topic, it's going to be very difficult for many people to ask for proof of domestic or sexual violence or threats thereof. And so I don't know how reasonable that is going to be. But keep in mind, you do have the right to request such information.
A leave that, of course, we're all familiar with is the parental leave, and that is undergoing some significant change. So what you see is the length of the leave will now correspond with the changes at the federal EI, employment insurance, level, right? So what you see is employees who suffer a stillbirth or miscarriage will see their leave entitlement increase, moving to 6 to 12 weeks of unpaid leave after the pregnancy loss. And the next two are the ones, of course, that you see most often. Parental leave will increase from 35 weeks to 61 if pregnancy leave is taken, or from 37 to 63 if it is not. And parental leave may begin no later than 78 weeks after the child is born or comes into the employee's custody for the first time. Note practical point number one, the rule will apply for parental leave, so this significant extension in parental leave, that begin on or after December 3rd, 2017. Okay, so now, in effect, right? And note point number two as well, that now you're going to have extended 18-month maternity parental leave situations. The replacement is now going to be for, effectively, let's call it an 18-month period of time, potentially. So those contracts with replacements have to be properly drafted, certainly to permit early terminations.
So this next leave of absence, I'm going to run through it rather quickly because we are up against some time constraints here. So it's the critical illness leave, and it's going to be replacing the critically ill child leave, so it's going to expand the leave to other family members, adult family members, and child family members that follow a critical illness or injury. So essentially, employees who have 6 months or more of service will be entitled to this new leave. Again, there's a dual entitlement for this leave. It's up to 17 weeks unpaid in a year period to care or support a critically ill adult family member, and up to 37 weeks versus the 17 weeks earlier, unpaid in a year period to care or support for a critically ill child under the age of 18 who is a family member of the employee. So it doesn't necessarily have to be your child, it just needs to be a child member of your family. So family members included in this definition include spouses, parents, grandparents, siblings, aunts, uncles, step-relatives, certain in-laws, and some non-relations considered to be like family members. This leave and the associated record keeping, which I'll get to very momentarily, are effective as of December 3rd, 2017. So it's another expanded leave to take care of critically ill family members.
Leave for the death of a child and for crime-related disappearance, that's an unpaid leave up to 104 weeks. And the unpaid leave for the crime-related disappearance has been increased from 52 months to 104 weeks. Family medical leave exists. It, under the current language, it's 8 weeks of unpaid leave in a 26-week period. That's now going to go up to 28 weeks of unpaid leave in a 52-week period. And the medical support for that is going to extend to qualified health practitioners, and that's going to be on, obviously, beyond just a GP. It's going to include, as you can see there, registered nurse, psychologist, etc. These changes are effective January 1st, 2018.
The next set of changes relate to temporary help agencies. There were some recent changes related to that recently, and now there's some more changes. Essentially, the first change is that temporary help agencies must provide at least 1 week of notice or pay in lieu of notice if an assignment estimated to last 3 months or more is ended early. So if a temporary help agency sends an employee on an assignment that's supposed to last at least 3 months and that assignment's ended early for whatever reason, the temporary help agency must provide at least 1 week notice or pay in lieu of notice, or the alternative would be to provide them with another assignment lasting at least 1 week. Agencies will be required to retain records relating to the termination of an assignment and provide written notice to the employee. As with the equal pay for equal work provisions, this is now also going to apply to agency employees who perform substantially the same work as employees of the client, which now means if you are retaining agency employees to backfill workload in your workplace, those agency employees must receive the same hourly rate for the exact for your employees that are doing the exact same thing or substantially the same thing. And so now that might be a deterrent to you from using temporary help agencies, because once you factor in the agency markup fees, those temporary help agency employees may ultimately kind of cost you more money than just retaining the employees on your own. And this change, again, is effective January 1st, 2018.
And, you know, and some people have commented, and quite frankly, it doesn't feel like that far off the mark, that this is the death knell for temporary help agencies. In light of what Alex just described, because of the obvious math associated with it, the economics of operating an agency are going to be challenged, no question about it. Record-keeping requirements, as we indicated earlier, more expansive record-keeping requirements. I'm not going to go through that list in the interest of time, but as you can see, once again, employers are going to have to pay attention to these record-keeping requirements. The 175 new officers that we haven't mentioned yet will be mentioning, they're going to be looking at this stuff.
A quick occupational health and safety change that aligns with some changes that were made in BC earlier this year. Specifically, employers can no longer require an employee to wear a heeled shoe unless required to perform work safely, so no high-heeled shoe wearing in certain businesses unless they fall within the exemption for performers in the entertainment and advertising industry, which is outlined on that slide. That change is already in effect as of November 27, 2017. So that's a brief, small change that relates to the Occupational Health and Safety Act. Now, how is the Ministry of Labor going to enforce all of these changes? Well, their approach is pretty much a twofold attack. One, they are enhancing employment standards enforcement. They are planning to hire, as Stu mentioned, up to 175 more employment standards officers and launching programs to educate both employees and small and medium-sized businesses about their rights and obligations under the new changes. Once they're hired, which they're aiming to do by 2020-2021, the Employment Standards Program has committed to resolving all claims filed within 90 days and inspect 1 in 10 Ontario workplaces. They've also increased the penalties for non-compliance to try to urge employers to comply with their obligations. They're increasing the flexibility around the administrative monetary penalties that ESA officers are permitted to give out to employers that do not comply with the ESA. The government also intends to amend the regulations under the ESA to increase the maximum administrative monetary penalties for non-compliant employers. And you can see the numbers there increasing almost one-third in many cases. And also these changes will allow the Director of Employment Standards to publish. So when you are found to have violated the Employment Standards Act, they will now be able to publish the names of the companies and the individuals who have been issued a penalty, a description of what the employer has done wrong, the date of the wrong contravention, and the amount of the penalty issued. So it's advertising to everyone out there for them to see that we have breached the Employment Standards Act and what that breach was.
Yeah, and remember, you know, your history with the Ministry of Labor makes a difference, right? If you're applying, for example, for an averaging permit for overtime or hours of work, right, they're going to look at contraventions and decide whether you're going to be granted that permit by way of example. So your history does make a difference, right? Okay, not only has the Employment Standards Act been revised in a material way, but the Labor Relations Act has also received significant attention. We don't have time to go through all the changes, and in fact, even in this presentation, we haven't outlined all the changes, but some of the key ones. I would say if you drop down to the bottom of that slide in front of you, card-based certification. So if you're in the building services industry, the home care and community services industry, and that's pretty wide when you start talking about community services industry, or, surprise, surprise, the temporary help agency industry, you are now going to be subject to what's called a card-based certification process. Currently, if a union secures 40% support in the bargaining unit, then the board orders a secret ballot vote. Now, the board will simply count the cards. And if there are sufficient cards to certify, no vote will be held in those industries. So that is a significant change in those industries. The other notable change is with respect to employee lists. Now think about this. You don't necessarily have to close your eyes, but perhaps it's helpful to close your eyes because this is significant. Now what a trade union can do, it can go before the Ontario Labor Relations Board and say to the board, we want an order directing the employer to provide us with an employee list that includes phone number, personal email, name, so that we can now organize the entirety of our proposed bargaining unit. The precondition to getting that order from the board is only 20% of the bargaining unit. So if the union succeeds in getting 20 out of 100 employees in that bargaining unit to sign cards, and the other 80 say, in a very dignified way, go find a lake and start swimming, they can go get that personal information of those 80 employees and now badger them to secure their support for the union. Pretty remarkable stuff. Right now, that will now be available to unions.
So what's next? Well, first, even though there's a lot of negative information here, unfortunately, don't panic. We are here to assist all of our clients with your organization's transition, and we've outlined a lot of practical points during this presentation. We will have more practical points to discuss with each of our individual clients to address their individual needs. We're also going to be contacting our clients with an action plan to address updates to their employee handbooks. Given these changes, there will be some handbooks, many handbooks, that are going to need to be amended to address these changes, and we have strategies as it relates to that. And as always, if you have specific questions, and I know there were a number of questions during this presentation that we were unable to get to today, don't hesitate to contact our team. We will schedule calls with advisors. We will go through all of your questions and help you get in compliance, and that includes the questions that were issued today, and I'm sure Stu has some closing thoughts. But again, thank you for your patience today. I know it wasn't as fun as many of our past e-learnings, but we did need to go through all of these points with you today. So,
not surprisingly, many of you have questions, and that's perfectly understandable. Given our time constraints, of course, we were not able to address those questions during the currency of this presentation, but as always, we will reach out to you to schedule a call with an advisor to respond to your questions. And of course, as always, we're always available to walk you through, take you through these changes to the Employment Standards Act and the Labor Relations Act. And given this is our last presentation before the holidays, we indeed wish you a very safe and joyous holiday season and an exciting new year, notwithstanding the effective dates of most of this legislation is January 2018, but hopefully you can remain smiling despite some of these provisions. So with that said, have a great day, and thanks for attending. And thanks, Alex, for doing all the laborious legwork on this.